KPFT can have a profound effect on how you live. You listen to KPFT because it expands your understanding of yourself and of the world. And we can continue to bring you great ideas and culture because listeners like you contribute. So why wait for a pledge drive to support KPFT? Give a call to our membership department at 713-526-4000, extension 314. Again, that number is 713-526-4000, extension 314, to speak to our membership department and become a member. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Good evening and welcome to So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're only going to find it here on KPFT, Houston's community radio. I am your host, Hank Rubicek, and along with the best team on radio, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, Tatiana Gago, Eric Heen, Chrissy Gorman, and Harwood Taylor, we celebrate the power of story by inviting storytellers to take us on astonishing journeys through windows of their souls. We are amid our fund drive, and if you can, I sure would be grateful for your donations because Pacifica Radio, this station, listener-sponsored KPFT, brings you the quality programming that you come to expect, especially in this award-winning program, So What's Your Story? And tonight, we put the spotlight on Mr. Harold B. Carter, a special man whose stories were captured for the Library of Congress's World War II Oral History Project, and whose story will be told by his son, Dan Carter, Professor Emeritus at Penn State University. There's a whole lot to be said about Dan, and it's on our Facebook page, but here's the short course. He served 22 years as director of the School of Theater and artistic director of Pennsylvania Center Stage. Before that position, he served as associate dean for production in the School of Theater at Florida State and chair of the theater department at Illinois State. He is past president of both the National Theater Conference and National Association of Schools in Theater and immediate past president of the College of Fellows of the American Theater. Before entering the world of college administration, Dan worked extensively as an actor, director, and fight director. He apprenticed at the Alley Theater here in Houston and has performed with Al Pacino in Richard III and Burt Reynolds in Smokey and the Bandit. And Dan, welcome, but the most important question on everybody's mind is, what part did you play in Smokey and the Bandit?
I was in Smokey and the Bandit 2. I played the gas station attendant who gets in a little scuffle with Bert after I tell him what I think of him.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Everybody loved him except you. And that was the beauty of it, right? That was the beauty of it. We are we're going to get you back on here one of these days to talk about that because that is a fun, fun movie. Dan, before we get into this wonderful story about your father, tell us the purpose for the Library of Congress's World War II Oral History Project.
The Oral History Project was created when folks realized that veterans of World War II were dying at an alarming rate and that all that personal history was dying with them. And so in October 2000, President Clinton signed legislation creating the Veterans History Project, and the bill was received unanimous support in both the House and the Senate. AARP was the founding corporate sponsor, and they provided funding and also spread the word to their members. And they're now trying to capture these stories in a more timely manner before we lose all the veterans of more recent wars.
Oh, yeah. So essential. You know, I think listeners will quickly understand the reason your father's stories are so important to the project. Introduce us to your dad.
My father was born 100 years ago next week, February 25th, 1921. His childhood was tough, but he'd be the first to say that the same was true for lots of people. His father died a few days after Dad turned six, probably TB. Then the Depression hit. And in 1935, 2 weeks after he turned 17, he enlisted in the Navy, leaving the hills of Northeast Arkansas to see the world. Though they were dirt poor, his mother, who taught in the one-room schoolhouse there, tried to bribe him with a new Ford if he would stay home. But he was determined, and he convinced her to sign for him since he was underage. He spent the next 3 years in Hawaii, which was even more of a paradise then. And there he became a signalman, and he boxed as a light welterweight under the name Spider Carter. He was court-martialed three times for fighting outside the ring, though he eventually got a good conduct medal, which he thought was pretty funny. About 6 months before the U.S. entered World War II, he shipped out to the Philippine Islands on a minesweeper, the USS Tanager, where they fortified Manila Bay and mined the harbor. With the end of his enlistment coming up, he put in his papers to go home, but was told, "We're going to war. By the time you get to the States, they'll just send you right back." The day after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Japanese began the Battle of the Philippines. The defense of Manila Bay, which was critical to the war effort in the Pacific, was deemed hopeless beyond a delaying action, so General MacArthur was evacuated, issuing his famous vow, "I shall return," from safety in Australia. Though General Homma promised Hirohito he'd take the Philippines in 2 months, U.S. forces held out for five, but Bataan fell in April, and the Tanager was sunk, leaving my dad a sailor without a ship, in Air Force coveralls, on beach defense with the Marines. Corregidor fell about a month later, and Dad spent the next 39 and a half months as a prisoner of the Japanese, who had never ratified the Geneva Convention. In World War II, German POWs died at a rate of a little over 1%, prisoners of the Japanese at 40%. Many died on the way to the camps as a result of the brutal conditions along the way, death, marches, starvation, disease. The Veterans Administration's former POW medical history form for my father documents the following: intimidation, daily, beatings, often, witnessed beatings, daily, physical torture, often, witnessed physical torture, often, psychological torture, once, suicidal thoughts, never, dysentery, pneumonia, worms, scabies, frostbite, loss of teeth, pellagra, beriberi. The dietary intake record reads, dairy products, no, meat, no, fish, no, potatoes, no, fruits, no, nuts, no. Listed as present but inadequate, water, broth, millet, legumes, vegetables, rice. His weight at the time of his liberation was 97 pounds, and my parents' wedding photo was actually taken on their first anniversary because he refused to have his picture taken till then. My older cousins who remember him from that time said he was scary to them because he looked like a skeleton. Remarkably, he was never bitter because he didn't take it personally. And the only man he truly hated from that time was an American major. He was the only man I ever really thought about killing. I used to lay awake at night studying on it, and I had it figured out just how I was going to do it. I probably would have regretted it later if I had. While many men who suffered similarly never talked about it afterwards, my father was a tireless storyteller, and my brother, my sister, and I grew up hearing about his childhood, his coming of age in Hawaii, and mostly about his time in captivity. Harsh stories about death and atrocities and survival. All told with the comic twist of a man who considered himself to be an observer, not a prisoner. Reveling in the freedom that came with figuring he was living on borrowed time anyway, and fueled by the menace of a very specific and ever-present enemy. He had a unique take on things, and little regard for anyone who showed weakness. What he found funny could be startling, and his stories are not for delicate sensibilities. The punchline was often, "And then they worked us over." Dad had a remarkable memory for details. As a signalman, he received their final message from FDR before their capture and recited it verbatim the rest of his life. "Each of you have doubled and redoubled your efforts time and time again. Now the enemy is at your door. May God be with each and every one of you." He also transmitted General Wainwright's pre-surrender directive to the men that they were all on their own until they could be rescued. In other words, every man for himself. And he took that to heart, throwing it in the face of any officer who tried to pull rank in camp. In the great American tradition, he never thought he was better than anyone else, but he knew he was as good as anybody. Dad was undaunted by all he went through, strengthened by it, truth be told. He went on to raise a family and dance and tell his stories and laugh that huge, hard laugh. In 2005, my brother and I accompanied Dad, then age 84, and his second wife, Faye, to Shenyang, China, to commemorate the opening of a museum on the site of the Houten prison camp where Dad had been known as Goachi Rei, Japanese for his prisoner number 580. Of the almost 1,500 wartime prisoners held there, only about 100 remained alive at that time, and only about 40 were still ambulatory. So when the opening date kept changing, it turned out that Dad was the only former prisoner to make it back, though others visited later. That trip was dramatic in its own way, though joyous this time, magical. Just short of his 92nd birthday, it having long since been established that nothing could kill him, he simply died.
Humble, proud, selfless. He loved to dance, tell stories, and had that hard laugh. I love those descriptors. You know, this overview is really a story in and of itself. But now, your father is captured.
I'll tell these next few stories in first person because that's the way I heard him.
Perfect.
Most people don't know this, but Skinny Wainwright took a motor launch across the 3-mile channel to Marvelous under a white flag to try and surrender us to General Homa, who asked, "Are you the Supreme Commander of the United States forces in the Far East?" "I am." "Then you will surrender the people down on Mindanao." And Wainwright said, "That's a renegade bunch down there. I don't have any contact with them." "Then you are denying your command." "You go back across and we'll come get you. And when we do, there won't be many of you left." We got captured. And the Japs sent us into the main tunnel and told us to stay inside until further orders, and they took off to take topside and the rest of the island. For weeks, we all knew there were only two ways off the island, killed or captured, which is it? Now that I knew, I was relieved, and you won't believe it, but I laid down and went into the deepest sleep with all my clothes on except my shoes. I woke up to screaming and hollering. A different bunch of Japs was holding reveille with bayonets, Marines, I think, in better uniforms, looking fresh, not like the ones that captured us. These didn't know that we'd already been captured, and they started lining us up in columns of five. They had us all put on our birthday suits, throw our clothes in the center of the road, and they started tying guys together, getting ready to march us off the cliff at the point of their bayonets. I was pretty far back, and I guess they ran out of lanyards, so I didn't get tied. And I was in the middle row, which was good because the guys on the outside were really catching it. If the Catholic boys had a rosary on or if you had a dog tag or a wristwatch, they'd swing at it with a bayonet. I figured I'd better get my dog tag off, but I couldn't pull it over my head. I had it on a little Filipino cord. Well, they say if you get excited, you can do anything. So I decided to break it, but I couldn't. So I chewed through that cord one strand at a time and slung it in the road. I didn't figure I'd ever see it again. This little Filipino standing next to me said, "They're going to kill us." I said, "No, they ain't," but it was pretty clear what they were getting ready to do. He said, "Oh, yes, this is just like they did the Chinese in China." And they started getting guys ready to jump them off the cliff, which is about 75 feet down with jagged coral sticking up. I knew I wasn't going to jump off that cliff. There was an old Marlin machine gun, one of ours, in a trench maybe 50 yards away, and it had a belt of ammunition hanging in it. So I decided that the first one over the cliff, I was going to run for that machine gun. I wouldn't have made it, but if I had, I was just going to sweep the road. You always wonder if you could have a sense of humor facing death when it's just seconds away. Here we were in our birthday suits in close quarters, me next to this Filipino, and the guy in front of him spins around and says, "Hot damn it, you're pissing all over me." And the Filipino says, "I know, Joe, but I can't help it." I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. If I'd have died right then, I'd have died laughing. Can you believe it? And then things got real quiet, and they were getting ready to march the first ones over. I was eyeing that Marlin. And the original ones that captured us came back and started raising hell. That second bunch started jackknifing, bowing, and saluting. I didn't understand any Japanese at the time, but I know what he would have been saying if he was American. "You damn rough gyrenes, if you think you're so tough, why don't you get up there where the fighting is and leave these prisoners alone?" They motioned us to get our clothes back on, which we did. Some knucklehead found my dog tag and brought it back to me. This one Jap was dying, and he reached out to shake my hand. So I took it, and he laid back down, closed his eyes. Another one come over to me and said, "Layla, Layla," and motioned me with his fingers down. So I backed up. And when I did, he slapped the piss out of me, which tickled me, really. I learned right away that they do it opposite of us. We motion, "Come here," with our fingers up. They do it with their fingers down. Our first work detail was to pick up the Japanese dead and burn them in one big pyre. They left our boys laying there for 3 days, just where they dropped, some of them still holding their rifles. After a few days, they shipped us over to Manila on landing barges. We pretty much all had dysentery, and guys were hanging over the side for a latrine. When we hit the beach, they lowered the ramp, and some of the guys took their shoes off, figuring it was a sandy bottom. But when they got to shore, the Japs wouldn't let them put their shoes back on, so when they finally did, their feet were all tore up. They marched us down Dewey Boulevard in the parade of shame. Japanese officers in their dress uniforms riding these beautiful little caramello ponies. We looked like a bunch of bums. Filipino civilians would try and slip us gidunks, candy and whatnot, when the Japs weren't looking. After a very short time, they packed us into boxcars so tight that when somebody died, they didn't even fall. Then we hiked to Cabanatuan, which was about 19 or 20 kilometers, I guess, which don't sound like much, but it was, with no food and general conditions. Rusty was a pretty good friend of mine. He kept saying, "I can't go any further. I'm going to fall out." Well, I didn't want him to get bayoneted, so I said, "Here, give me your kit." We didn't have much. We stopped at one point for general purposes, using the road as a latrine. I spied a road ditch, and the guards were up a way, so I said to Rusty, "Give me your canteen." And I slipped down and filled them up. It was a mud hole, really, and it was filled with larvae. I told him not to swallow it because of the wiggle tails, to just rinse his mouth out, but he said, "To hell with you," and chugged it down. I just swished it around a little and spit it out, and he drank mine, too. When we got to Cabanatuan, the division officer from my ship saw me and grinned real big. He said, "Hot damn, Carter, I should have known if anybody was going to make it, you would." We'd had some problems, but he looked like he was tickled to death to see me. They gave us some of that old rice they had for mess, and Rusty said, "Let's get in line." I said, "I ain't eating that crap." He said, "Well, get some and give it to me then." Shoot, a couple of days later, I couldn't get enough. I've been eating it ever since. We ate nothing but rice for 5 months, happy to get what little they gave us. And then we were detailed for Japan. They checked us for disease, said, "You will be guests of the emperor. We don't want you taking any disease to Nippon." I guess I was one of the healthy ones, so I was shipped out. I went to see Rusty in the infirmary. He knew he wasn't going anywhere. When we hit Japan, they gave us our first Japanese clothes, and we were glad to get shut of ours because we all had lice. We just changed right there on the dock. It wasn't long before they loaded us in the hold of a cargo ship for the trip across the Sea of Japan, what they came to call hell ships. It took us 30 days to get to Korea because we had to dodge American planes along the way. They didn't know it was us, and we were strafed a couple of times. It was rough below decks, just as you'd imagine. Every few days, they'd haul up the dead and throw them overboard. We took a train across Korea, crossed the Yellow River into Mukden, Manchuria. Japs called it Manchukuo, not too far from Vladivostok, Russia. And they marched us to Hoten prison camp, where we spent the rest of the war.
Wow, you know, the details, the dialogue. You know, some may ask, you know, why a story about your dad? Well, it's because a story conveys a face that represents the extraordinary group who are all but gone. The essential reason for this project. You know, the military trains its soldiers, Dan, to do the following when captured: try to escape, remember your surroundings, resist, keep the faith, and come home with honor. Your father possessed his own set of must-haves while he was imprisoned. Tell us about his daily life.
After being in the tropics and semi-tropics for 3.5 years, I ended up in Manchuria, which was 20 below or worse all the time in winter. The first so-called barracks they put us in, somebody said, were just old chicken coops. They had no floors, and the stove, such as it was, never did get so hot you couldn't put your hand on it. If you were lucky enough to have a canteen, the water in it froze, laying right next to you where you slept. It was about 3.5 miles to work that first year, and I was on maintenance detail, and I didn't want to work. I just pick up a tool and look busy walking all day in all weather, but it was better than being shut up in the factory or the barracks. Then I got transferred to factory detail. They had a factory making utility cranes just outside the wall, and the only time we got outside was going through that wall across the road to the factory. That's why I never did want to work in a factory after I got home. It was like being back in prison camp 8 hours a day. We sure as hell didn't intend to contribute to their war effort, so guys figured out ways to sabotage most of the work we did, build in flaws, defects, whatever. They didn't really have any inspection. Sometimes we'd drop hand tools in the shitter, and the Chinese who emptied them out weren't going to say anything. Hell, they were happy to get them. Suzuki-san was the factory foreman, and for some reason, he liked me. Conchiman was the interpreter, and he was always walking around making notes in a little book he carried in his shirt pocket. I think they liked me because by that time I'd learned to speak a little Japanese, not too well, but enough to communicate. Mostly we had three-way conversations. They knew some American words, and we'd throw in some Chinese words, but we made it work. Punishment was regular. Somebody was always catching it. One day I did something to piss old Conchman off, don't remember what, could have been anything, and he laid into me, throwing lefts and rights, 1-2, 1-2. I rode the punches, turning my head and stepping back as they landed, so they didn't do any damage, but he marched me back across the room till he wore himself out and dropped his hands. And when he did, I shot out a right and stopped it just in front of his nose. Then I laughed and dropped my hands. His eyes got big. He said, "Your problem is you do not understand the Japanese way of punishment." I said, "The hell I don't. I've been living with you bastards for 3 years. The sergeant beats the corporal beats the private. You don't embarrass me, not one bit. But I'll tell you one thing. If my hands weren't tied, and I don't mean with rope, it'd take me about 2 minutes to teach you the American way of punishment." He looked me up and down, studying me real good. Then he said, "Maybe one day I'd be your prisoner, then you beat me." I said, "Write that down. Put it in your book." I worked every machine in the place, running scrap to it till I learned it, then transferring to another one until it finally got boring, and I figured any work I did after that, I'd be producing. To this day, I can't believe I got away with all I did. They didn't know what to think of me. One day I just went on strike. I told Suzuki, "Do whatever you're going to do because I'm done." I knew I was going to pay for it, but I couldn't believe it. He just smiled and said, "Okay." I guess he figured I was having a bad day. So that went on for, I don't know how long, a couple of days, till Suzuki had enough. He came over and said, "Chikoto, go to work." And he grabbed me by the neck and he yanked me up. I slung him across the aisle and sat back down. And he went running off to the office, chop, chop. It's not like it is here. The factory president's office is right there on the floor. Man, all those other GIs got busy looking it over at me thinking, what the hell has Carter done now? But I didn't kid myself. I knew I was in trouble. So I sat there till I figured Suzuki had enough time to unload. Then I got up and casually strolled to the office and opened the door. There was a little Australian lieutenant in there to interpret. Well, he wasn't little. He was pretty good size, but he was scared to death. He said, okay, now just stay calm and let me do the talking. I told him, I don't have any trouble communicating with these people, so you just sit there unless I ask you to say something. Otherwise, just keep your ass out of it. The president was sitting behind his desk, and he looked up over his glasses and says, real nice and easy, cigarito sabas? Real nice. I couldn't believe it. It isn't supposed to be like that. What is the problem? I told him, I don't have a problem, but your foreman apparently does. I told him I wasn't going to do any more work. Why do you not work? I'm still an American. Well, after being so nice, he leaned forward and jabbed his finger in the air and said, you can do good work. You have done good work and you will do good work. What machine do you want? I told him it didn't matter because I wasn't going to work anyway. I wanted to get on farm detail. It was just a little garden, really, but I figured I'd get outside and maybe get a raw potato once in a while. Then I said, oh, there is one machine I haven't been on yet, the gear shaper. That might be fun for a little bit. He barked at Suzuki, 580 gear shaper, and he motioned me to leave. I started out, and when I got to the door, I turned back and I said, I've changed my mind. What do you mean? You've got a Chinese on the gear shaper, and as far as I know, that's his livelihood. I don't want to take his job away from him. They couldn't believe it. Just put me back on the lathe, I said, and I walked out. So they put me on a Japanese lathe this time and brought me a gear blank. I threw it in the chuck and cut the outside diameter down, took out the drill bit out and cut a hole in it. I put the cutting tool in there and made a couple of cuts through there, got a bunch of shavings, and then I turned off the feed. Whenever a guard came around, one of the guys would yell, air raid, which was our signal, and I turned the feed back on, and they thought I was really working. One day, I noticed my shavings were looking cankered, sort of rusty, so every couple of days, I made another batch. After a little while, here came what I was looking for. 580 relieved from factory detail. I couldn't believe it. Transferred to farm detail. The first day on farm detail, I figured I better break this guy in right. If you don't, they really make it rough on you. I was hoeing potatoes, which I'd done all my life, but I guess he figured since I was new, he was supposed to show me how. When he took the hoe, I said, oh, you're going to hoe for a while? And I started talking to the other guys and didn't pay him any attention. When he gave me the hoe back, I'd start digging potatoes. This went on a couple of times, and then he caught me by surprise and jerked the hoe out of my hands, making me lurch forward. I snapped, son de cheat you, sorry, son of a bitch, and he slapped the piss out of me, which he should have done. They always learn the bad words first. I took the hoe back and commenced the digging, and he just walked off. One of the other guys came up to me a little later and said, man, you really got him going. He came up to me and said, what's wrong with that guy? He just keeps talking and laughing. I hit him and he doesn't even pay any attention to me. I told him, he won't pay any attention to you. In our military, he outranks you. He won't even talk to you. But when he gets back to camp, he'll report you to the officers. Shit, I knew what would happen if I reported him. But he was scared, I guess. He came over and started buttering me up, offered me a cigarette. I didn't pay him any attention. Then the shift was over and we headed back in. He was talking to me, telling me jokes, getting desperate because he was running out of time. But I knew I was too. Just before we reached the wall, he said something and I busted out laughing like it was the funniest thing I ever heard. He thought he made it just in time. We never got any news, but we figured the Japs, or rather the Americans, must be making some headway because the Japs started having air raids. They'd sound the alarm and run us back to camp. There wasn't any cover there, no foxholes or anything, but they didn't want us outside the wall if there was bombing. Well, one day they were double-timing us back to camp, and I started thinking, if this is a real air raid, I don't want to get caught out here in the open field. So I accelerated a little, passing the lead guard. He did the same, passed me back. So I kicked it into higher gear and passed him, and he did too. We did that all the way back to camp, just getting faster and faster, passing each other, swapping the lead back and forth. We got back to the wall, and we were bent over, breathing hard, and we looked behind us, and the rest of those guys were strung out all the way back. But I really horsed up, outsmarted myself. I guess the foreman figured he didn't want anything to do with me. I wasn't there but just a little while when a new roster goes up. 580 Textile Factory, Branch Camp 3. There wasn't any fooling around there. You had to make 30 meters of canvas a day, and you didn't quit till you did. It was dark in there, close. The air was stale. I knew all the guys, but I hadn't seen them for a while, and they were like zombies, just staring into space. I said, "Hey, so-and-so." He just stared, never said a word. That was a hellhole. I was lucky that was near the end of the war, so I didn't spend much time there. That was a hellhole.
Yeah, you know, you shared a great comment with me in an email when you quoted one of our recent guests, folk teller Joel Ben-Izzy. You said, "Some stories are better to hear than to live through." And this narrative about your father isn't anything we want to live through, but as writer Joan Didion asserts, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. This is Hank Rubicek with guest storyteller Dan Carter on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT Houston's Community Radio, 90.1 FM on our dial, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 with our friends in Huntsville. This riveting story of Harold Carter is the type of story peppered through a tapestry of personal narratives and traditional tales brought to you every week on So What's Your Story? An icon, really, in community radio, and one that punctuate the power of listener-sponsored programming. We are in a fund drive, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, and if you can go to www.kpft.org with your generous donations, so that programs like this can continue to be part of this eclectic community, I sure would appreciate it. But you know, if donating is difficult, and I certainly understand why it would be, we all ask you to do one thing, and that is join us every week, tune in every week. That's the best kind of support. But you know, also supporting our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is a great way to develop skills in your own storytelling. Zoom into our monthly story swaps, the fourth Tuesday of every month, by accessing the link on our website, www.houstonstorytellers.org. Our next swap is February 23rd from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And while you're on our site, by the way, why not become a member? We make it easy. Please visit our So What's Your Story Facebook page for guest and program information. And if you have ideas for a show or a guest, maybe even yourself, drop us a note at story@kpft.org, and one of us will get back to you, I promise. Also, the Tejas Storytelling Festival is coming up next month, March. So think about registering and becoming a member and take your skills to the next level. I will have the registration material on our Facebook page. So focus on that, please. Dan, at what point did you realize that your father's story needed to be conveyed to others?
Wow. You know, he's told these stories all my life, and I've told a lot of them to my friends over the years, and they always responded well to them because they're pretty fascinating, I think. But, you know, I attended a reunion with him once, and two grown siblings came up to me afterwards. Their father wasn't there. He had died. And they said, you know, he was in that same prison camp, but he never talked about it. And I wish he had, because we need to know this stuff.
Yeah, we do. It is remarkable how many people don't like talking about things. My family are Holocaust survivors, I mentioned to you. And my mother didn't talk much. My grandmother did, and my grandfather didn't at all. And I was always frustrated. I wanted all of them to share things with me, but some of them just couldn't, as dug deep inside of their soul as that information was. You entitle the next segment of this story, Liberation, but it's not to be taken literal. Tell us that part.
They had unique ways of punishment. One day they had a detail fall in, about 20 guys, and I wasn't supposed to go, but this one knucklehead laid out gold bricking, so I jumped in, figuring I'd take care of him later, which I fully intended to do. They thought I was the one who was late. The corporal in charge said, "I'll teach you that when we say fall in, we mean fall in." They marched us out to a field, and it was probably 20 below or so, and they said, "Strip down naked and run across this field and back." It was probably 100 yards each way. Well, as soon as they said it, you knew you were going to have to do it, so I put on my birthday suit and ran down and back. The ground was frozen, and it crackled, and every step I got lower to the ground. It was rough, but I figured just do it and get it over with. Well, I got back and put my clothes on and stood there laughing at them other guys. Some of them haven't even started getting undressed. This Jap said, "Warm, huh?" And I was. I couldn't believe them other guys. Some of them were crying. I just never could get used to grown men crying. Some people say, "Why didn't you try to escape?" And the three guys did. Chastain, Pagliotti, and this other guy. They got caught when Japanese thrust their bayonets in the wagon full of hay they were hiding in. They starved them for about a month, then made them dig their own graves and shot them. After that, they said for any one who escaped, they'd kill five on each side of you. I went up to the guys in what they called our squad, and I said, "If you've got anything like that planned, tell me, and I'll be right behind you." I wasn't going to stay back and get shot. They said they would. There was this one guy especially who was a real character, and I didn't know what he might get up to, but he said he'd tell me. One day they took him out, strung him up, used him for bayonet practice. No telling what he'd done. He was a character. Christmas of 44, I started feeling bad, but I thought I could make it through TECO, roll call, but I passed out standing there, and they shook me awake. I was pretty much out of it, and I figured I was in a fight, so I squared up. It was the bull leaning over me, and he wasn't somebody you messed with. He'd worked me over pretty well a few times. But I guess he could see I was delirious, so they carried me to what they called the infirmary. And as I lay there, I saw the attendant injecting other guys, so I called him over. I said, "Give me some of that." He said, "You don't want any of this. We're just easing these guys out." I said, "Keep walking." There was a shed there we used as a kind of a charnel house in the winter, because the ground was frozen solid. We'd stack the bodies up in there like cordwood and bury them in the spring. The rest of this I only know because I was told later. I lost consciousness, and they figured I'd be dead by morning anyway, so they threw me on top of all the other bodies in that shed. But that night, for the first time since we'd been in camp, the Red Cross got through, and they brought in penicillin and sulfa. Next morning, one of my buddies said, "You know, technically, Carter wasn't dead yet. We had to at least go see if he made it through the night." Well, the next thing I remember was waking up to see this attendant getting ready to stick a needle in my arm. I slapped at it and said, "Get the hell out of here with that." He said, "Look at your arms. I've been sticking you with this for a week." I looked like a pincushion. We found out the war was over when a couple paratroopers and the translator dropped into camp and the Japs stood down. Everybody went a little nuts, not knowing what to do. Some guys picked up rifles and stood posts where the Japs had just been. I was sitting in the barracks and remembered, I've got an appointment with Conchman. I wouldn't want to disappoint the boy. So I went over to his office to teach him the American way of punishment. But when I got there, a couple dozen guys were lined up out the door waiting their turn at him. I just walked off. I didn't want any part of that. We were told we were still on lockdown and nobody was to leave. And I said, "To hell with that. I was told I was on my own and I meant to go to town." I told Wilkes, this guy from Louisiana, to see if he could find a hacksaw to cut through the bars in the one drain pipe that was in the wall. When we'd cut through it, this limey guard came up and said, "Where do you think you're going?" And we said, "Into town to get something to eat." He said, "Oh, no, you're not." I said, "You think you're going to stop us?" And he threw one in the chamber. He stopped us. When the shift changed, I grabbed Wilkes and said, "Let's go down there again." This American was on duty. He asked us what we were doing. I said, we're going to town unless you act like that Limey did. He said, I don't care if you all go. And off we went. We had new Air Force coveralls on, and our pockets were full of candy that had been airdropped in. And when we hit town, we heard this voice in perfect English say behind us, would you boys like a nice Chinese dinner? We turned, and there was this nice-looking man, Dr. Sun, well-dressed. And he said, we said, you bet. When people saw us walking down the street, doors and window shutters started slamming shut. Dr. Sun said, they think you're Russian. First, we went to his hospital and we passed out candy to the patients. Everybody was tickled to see us. Then he took us to his home. And first we went in to see his mother, who was old and bedridden, blind. He told her who we were and she reached out her hand sort of feebly. I took it and she squeezed it and said, Wody Shohai, my boys. Then we ate like we hadn't eaten since before the war. We got back to camp and they said, where in the hell have you been? They raised hell and locked us up. Can you believe it? 39 and a half months prisoner of the Japanese, and the next day the Americans locked me up. And the next morning they came to let us out, and I said, the hell with that. You knuckleheads haven't been out of camp yet, and you're all just running around acting the fool. I can get some rest in here. Just bring me some more food. One of the officers came in and said I'd be held till a court-martial could be arranged. I told him I couldn't care less. After we were liberated, one of the naval officers came to check on me and asked me what was going on. I told him, and he said, that bunch has got a lot to learn. You've got nothing to worry about. I said, I think you can see I'm not. That was the last I heard of it.
Wow. Now we get back to you. You take a return trip.
My mother died in 1993, and my dad remarried a couple years later and moved back to Arkansas. Faye read somewhere that there was to be a reunion of POWs from Hoten in Dallas, and she thought they should go. Dad sloughed it off and said he wasn't interested, and she said, well, I'll tell you all about it when I get back. So they went, and that started a whole new period in my dad's life. He was reunited with guys who had gone through the same experience, some of whom he had known at the time. And on the 60th anniversary of the end of the war, the Chinese decided to create one of their atrocity museums on the site of the prison camp, with ex-prisoners invited to come back for the commemoration. The date kept changing, so Dad was the only one to make the first trip. And we're eternally thankful to Pat and A.O. Wang for their vision and generosity in making this happen. My brother Randy and I accompanied Dad and Faye, and we flew to Shenyang. Among the things we saw there was a copy of the letter ordering the camp commander to annihilate them all and leave no traces in order to cover up the atrocities that had been committed. The execution date was set for August 29th, but the horrors inflicted on Hiroshima and Nagasaki brought an abrupt end to the war and prevented that. Dad said there were two things he wanted to do. The first was to visit Boot Hill, the cemetery where they buried the dead, but he was told there was now a high-rise apartment complex where the graveyard stood, that the remains had all been repatriated back to the States years ago. The other thing was to try to connect with Dr. Sun's family. He said he's probably dead, but he was a doctor at the hospital there. Somebody ought to be able to find him or his family. Dr. Sun and Dad had sent letters back and forth for years after they met, until the Cultural Revolution happened and all communication ceased abruptly. Mukden wasn't very big before the war, but after the Great Leap Forward and forced urbanization, Shenyang had become one of the largest cities in the world, over 8 million people in the city proper and over 23 million in the greater metropolitan area. Unlike Beijing, which is a cosmopolitan international city, Shenyang is very insular. The only people we saw outside the American consulate were Chinese, and the only people who spoke English were the interpreters. It was a huge event, and Dad was given a hero's welcome. We stayed in the Grand Hotel where Chairman Mao had regularly hosted the provincial governors, and Dad was followed by an entourage, including reporters from two newspapers and three television stations. There was an academic conference, and Dad comfortably held forth, answering questions logistical, historical, and personal. At one point, a reporter asked what he thought about the Japanese, and he said, "I learned that you have to take everybody individually. There's good and bad in all of us." He told a story about meeting Dr. Sun, which literally became front page news for both papers, which ran lead articles above the fold, accompanied by a picture of Dad holding up a photo of Dr. Sun with his wife and son, with a blow up of the photo underneath. Next morning at breakfast, one of our party got a call on his cell phone from one of the newspapers that had run the story. They said, "We think we found them." A few minutes later, after another call, we were told, "They'll be here for lunch." Back at the hotel, after a meeting at the U.S. consulate, there was a flurry of activity as more press gathered to cover the reunion. Dr. Sun had indeed passed away, but four members of his family showed up. We met the young boy in the photo, now a man who seemed much older than my father, though he must have been 20 years younger. He was in pretty bad shape and was quiet the entire time. I don't know that he ever spoke. There was also a younger son we hadn't known about, and he had his wife and one of his sons with him. Dr. Sun was an educated man who spoke at least two languages, but because of the dictates of the Communist Party, his sons and daughter-in-law were factory workers, and his grandson was a baker. They spoke no English, just as we spoke no Chinese. Everyone was excited, and the daughter-in-law was particularly effusive. She said, "Dr. Sun taught me to read the newspaper every day, which is why I saw this story." At one point, my brother said, "All our lives we heard the story about the doctor who fed our father." And the grandson said, "All my life I heard the story about the two GIs who came to dinner." The sons asked us to join them at their home for dinner the next evening, but we were booked on the train to Beijing. Early the next morning, my brother and I headed down to breakfast at the hotel, but when the elevator opened on our floor, the second son and his wife were there holding shopping bags full of food for our train trip. It all came from the bakery their son worked at. They'd already traveled over an hour to get to us, so there's no telling how early in the morning they started. We were blown away by their generosity. We all went down for breakfast together and were greeted with more front page news articles about the reconnection this time, with a picture of my father and the older son, each holding identical copies of the original family photo. They accompanied us to the train where we had an emotional send-off, and we ate like kings all the way to Beijing, once again feasting on the bounty of the sons.
Beautiful, beautiful. That was my dog in the background barking. He really appreciates your story too. You know, listeners have to know, like, we're doing all these shows, all these programs are being recorded at home, and it kind of adds warmth. So I just,
yeah, they might have heard my cats a little earlier too.
There you go. I mean, my God, talk about just appealing to every possible mammal. So tough to choose these segments of this story to tell, but you know, the episodes that you select clearly paint this astonishing image about your father. As an appropriate and I think really poignant ending, you've got the first letter that your dad wrote to your mother after the Japanese capitulation. Read it to us.
Yeah, this is a letter I just came across a couple weeks ago, actually. And it's a letter to his mother. I'm excerpting this. "Am writing this letter from the ex-prisoner of war camp, which is now American held. It was a long, hard grind, but was worth the effort. Not going to try to tell you everything in a letter, as it will keep for a few weeks when I will enjoy telling you in person. Boy, oh boy, you should see us go after the first decent food we have had in 3.5 years. This is the place where we who have existed are made of steel, where heavyweights went to featherweights. But is it going to be fun putting real flesh on these old bones again? You probably figured in what mail you may have received from me everything was okay. That was for your benefit. But as it is all over with, the truth can be told. I am in good health, so far as I know anyway. I still have all my limbs and no scars. Lucky man. I wouldn't take $1 million for my experience and wouldn't go through it again for the world. Our prison camp was bombed last December 7th, a regrettable mistake by our airmen, with several killed all around me, others with limbs blown off. I was right in the center, but untouched. That night, we enjoyed ourselves with a musical program. After what these men have seen, nothing can break any one of them down. My mind is in an uproar with the thoughts of seeing you sooner than you expect. Have lots in mind to do when I reach home again, but most to try to repay you for all the worry which I must have caused you. Tell Alberta that the picture she sent for me for Christmas in Hawaii and all my prized possessions went to the bottom when the ship was sunk, so we will have to have many more made when I return. Upon arriving in U.S., I will spend some time getting back in A1 condition to where I can really enjoy life again. I never realized a man could exist on the food and treatment we have had for so long a time, but we have a large graveyard here to prove that everyone could not.
Beautiful. You know, Pacifica Radio was founded during the peace movement in 1948, and this story about your father is a story incarnate, really, for this station. Dan, you know, I know you haven't told these stories on the radio before, but as you tell them, as they unfold, how does it make you feel telling these stories on the air for the first time?
Well, you know, I feel happy getting them out because my father always was interested in getting them out, you know. You know, I think of Henry Louis Gates' Finding Your Roots series. I mean, why would I be interested in watching somebody else learn about their family tree? But you tune in and it's fascinating. I mean, stories bring the human level to the grand sweep of history. And I think that's what my father's stories do. I mean, you know, otherwise it's just memorizing dates and statistics. 1066, the Battle of Hastings. 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. That's too big a number to get your mind around. You can't think of it as a group that big. You have to think of it as Abraham and Moshe and Sarah and Lev. Let me tell you about Sarah.
And I think that really does make very clear why it is so important that your father, that these stories about your dad teach us about the power of story, right? I mean, this is exactly why the power of story is important.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't Alvin York or Audie Murphy. He was just a guy who did what was put in front of him.
Thank you, Dan, so much. You know, Dan Carter, you prove what novelist Margaret Atwood touts, and that is that we will never kill storytelling because it's built into the human plan. We come with it. I have a question for you, Dan, that I really think that I think our listeners will really appreciate. You listen to your father's stories, obviously, all of your life. Well, growing up, at least, you heard a lot of his stories. What did your dad teach you about the art of storytelling?
It's interesting because I guess I learned a lot of it innately from him. And when I studied it in college, I studied acting and theater, I learned to articulate what I had learned from him, if that makes sense. I mean, he made it come to life. He relived it as he told it. And he made the other people come to life. And that's, you know, that's a gift.
Yeah. Boy, it sure is. So beautiful. Thank you, Dan. We're going to get you back on here. I promise. I don't want anybody to move because Lars and the Tennyson tape deck is up next with the sweet mix of singer-songwriters. Please make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home or tuning in for the night or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. Thank you.
It's time for the Dove to retire and time for a brand new look for KPFT. KPFT needs a new logo, and we want you in the KPFT community to design it for Houston's community station. We're putting on a logo design contest and asking you to submit your ideas for a new logo for KPFT. All the info you need, including contest rules, a website for uploading your submissions, can be found at kpft.org. We'll be accepting logo design submissions through March 1st. And then the funnest part begins. Starting at 12:01 p.m. on March 1st, the community gets to vote on their favorite designs. Voting ends at 11:59 on March 5th. The top five vote-getters will constitute the pool of designs from which the winner will be chosen, and the winning design and designer will be revealed on the air and on the internet March 8th. Visit kpft.org for all the details. We cannot wait to see what kind of artistic genius lives in our community. So get your designs together and get them in before March 1st. Help us design a brand new look for Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1. Houston.
Whether it's the memories of great songs or the up-to-the-minute news and talk you've come to depend on, KPFT means something to you. It means something to our volunteers too. They've decided to dedicate some of their time off to helping the station that's helped them. Volunteering at KPFT is more than just contributing time. It's about being part of something special, unique, exciting. Independent radio in a city where non-commercial, volunteer-driven stations are a rare breed. So call 713-526-4000 or visit kpft.org to download a volunteer application to indicate your interests. Spend some time at this great station, make some new friends, and be a part of something truly unique. Again, that's 713-526-4000 or visit kpft.org. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
When you listen to KPFT, you hear things that you would expect to hear on a community radio station. Relevant news, the arts, great music.
But when you tune into KPFT, you also hear things you wouldn't expect. You hear different perspectives that make you think about our world in a new way.
Pacifica's mission statement is about building understanding between nations and people. What you hear on KPFT can have a profound effect on how you live.
You listen to KPFT because it expands your understanding of yourself and of the world. And we can continue to bring you great ideas and culture because listening